Members, I call this meeting to order. Chair Torkelson, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have reviewed the minutes, Mr. Chair, and I recommend their approval.
All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none opposed, the minutes of April 7, 2026 are approved. Members, today we will be hearing about the economic impact of Operation Metro Surge. We do have a number of testifiers, so we will be asking members to save their questions until the end and asking all the testifiers, if they can, to stay around to answer any questions that members may have. We're going to get right into it. So first testifier, Patricia Nauman, please step up, introduce yourself for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. Metro Cities represents the collective interests of cities across the metropolitan area at both the legislature and executive branch, as well as the Metropolitan Council. Thank you for the opportunity to comment this morning. I am here to share recent action by the Metro Cities Board of Directors in late January. The Metro Cities Board did hold a special meeting in late January to discuss the federal Metro Surge and ICE enforcement activity in Minnesota and its impacts, especially for cities in the metropolitan area, which is the focus, of course, of our association. That discussion did yield some general discussion and information from board members on what they were experiencing in their local communities. Those experiences did vary, the impacts did vary, but generally what many cities through our board did highlight was both the immediate effects that they were seeing on residents and businesses, as well as the sudden and unexpected impacts and burdens on city operations and services. These would include things like public safety, public works, emergency management, and other local costs. In its discussion, the board did recognize that some of these local impacts and costs, while some are immediate, will continue to be felt and experienced over the longer term. And as such, the board did adopt a policy at its meeting that does support state assistance for cities to address these unexpected local impacts and expenses. Metro Cities will continue to work with its member cities as more specific data and information are known on local expenses and overburdens as they are identified. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Up next, we have Aaron Rosenthal from the North Star Policy Action. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Frazier, Co-Chair Torkelson, members of the committee. I'm Aaron Rosenthal. I'm the Research Director for North Star Policy Action. We're a think tank dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. Amidst lives lost, families torn apart, and children traumatized, it can feel a bit crass to talk about dollars and cents, but the truth is that there has been a tremendous economic impact from Operation Metro Surge, and we must be sure to account for it even as we keep the human impact in mind. To date, much of the economic impact from DHS actions has been documented through individual stories of businesses being harmed. Our goal as a think tank has been to build on those stories by providing a clearer picture of the broader damage done to Minnesota's workers and economy. Since January, we've released four reports in pursuit of this goal. These reports point to a clear and consistent conclusion. Over the last several months, people have lost jobs, fewer small businesses have been operating, fewer Minnesotans have gone to work, and those that did worked shorter hours. The result has been profound economic harm. Our most recent analysis suggests Operation Metro Surge was deeply implicated in the state's increased unemployment rate in January 2026, which rose above the national average for the first time in nearly two decades. We found that the sectors hit hardest were not random, but instead represented the ones most exposed to DHS harassment, such as restaurants. In January, accommodation and food services lost 3,300 jobs. That represents the industry's largest non-pandemic drop on record in Deeds data, which goes back to 2007. But unemployment tells only part of the story. Many workers did not lose their jobs. They kept them, but were too afraid to show up. That harm shows up in another striking statistic. On average, Minnesotans worked 32.1 hours in January 2026, the lowest number on record in DEEDS data. I think that's worth repeating. Minnesotans worked fewer hours in January 2026 than any month since at least 2007, including the pandemic. When people work less, they also earn less. In a separate analysis, we estimated the impact of these reduced hours on wages. Comparing the Twin Cities to other metro areas, we estimated that hours worked fell by roughly 2% between early January and mid-February. That may sound small, but that decline translates into at least $106 million in lost wages. And that $106 million is just a partial cost. It excludes lost wages experienced in the rest of the state. It excludes lost business revenue as this drop in wages rippled through the economy. It excludes the $18 million that we estimate taxpayers spent each week to support Operation Metro Surge. And it excludes costs realized through increased mental health care and rising rent burdens. While some of these losses may become clearer as more data is released, it's likely we will not have a full accounting of the harm done for years, especially as we come to understand the impact of Operation Metro Surge on children and schools and their future educational attainment and lifetime earnings. Put simply, our estimates provide a conservative floor, and we hope that lawmakers will take that into account, as the scale of any relief provided by the state must consider the scale of what's happened to Minnesota's small businesses and workers. Much of the human cost of the past few months cannot be undone through state assistance, but the economic damage from Operation Metro Surge provides an opportunity for the state to take meaningful, reparative action. Workers have lost wages, small businesses have suffered, and communities have absorbed the harm. The state has both the capacity and the responsibility to address those losses. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, we have St. Paul Mayor Collier. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Frazier, Chair Torkelson, and members of the committee, my name is Kalihar, and I'm the mayor of the city of St. Paul. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to all of you on the topic of Operation Metro Surge today. Today I will be speaking specifically to the economic impact, but I want to also share that the cost to our cities and to our residents goes far beyond just the economic cost. That just in the city of St. Paul that we had almost $1 million in additional costs just associated with Operation Metro Surge, that we had an estimated overtime and staff time of over 10,842 hours. And, that is not speaking to even just what happened with our school district where thousands of students go on to remote learning. We saw after the pandemic that children who spent a significant amount of time away from in classroom, but getting them back to school afterwards was a huge challenge, and that led to learning gaps for our students as well. And so I just want to be very clear that that what we're talking about today, maybe there's the pure economic cost of it, but there's been huge human health and just a community cost to all of this as well. And so with that, I just want to share that I am in huge support of House File 4477, and I want to thank Representative Jay Zhang and Representative Frazier for the bill. I would urge all of you to keep this a priority as you look to see what you can do this session. As somebody who came from this place and went to work in a city and now is the mayor, that this is not a partisan issue. And this is not a city of St. Paul, Minneapolis issue. This is a statewide issue, and this impacts your business, whether you are a Democrat or a Republican. Small businesses are the backbone of St. Paul's economy, and what we are seeing in the wake of Operational Metro Surge is a catastrophic collapse in our local economy. I'm speaking to you today in hopes of getting your support to keep businesses open, people employed, and neighborhoods stable. In St. Paul, we estimated small businesses lost approximately $16 million per week, about $64 million per month, and $129 million over just January and February. These are very conservative estimates that we had. We also have a formal partnership with the University of San Diego, who will do a much more formal assessment of this. But we really did take quite a bit of time and worked with our small businesses to make sure that we could have an accurate view of what was happening to them. You know, businesses reported that they saw a 50% drop in foot traffic and a 40% decline in sales, with the greatest impacts in restaurants, retail, personal services, and neighborhood grocery stores that are frequented by our refugee and immigrant communities. This is not a typical downturn. Businesses were open, but customers stayed home. And workers could not show up as usual, and cornerstone events were canceled. This is government-driven disruption, not a failure of the businesses themselves. Businesses didn't make bad decisions. Their entire customer base was upended, and the environment changed. The impacts are still falling hardest on neighborhood-based and immigrant-owned businesses, many of which operate on very thin margins. These businesses anchor our neighborhoods and commercial corridors. When they struggle, entire communities feel it. This disruption is impacting the entire state and exceeds the capacity of any one city to address alone. City resources are limited and not designed for rapid, large-scale economic shock like this. The budget that I inherited was adopted last year, and so there's not room for me to be able to just make adjustments to support our businesses, the millions of dollars that were lost. It is imperative for the financial health of our state that we act quickly to prevent businesses from closing. It has become so clear to me that when I watch my businesses, it took 2 months for them to lose enough business that they are shutting doors or considering still shutting their doors, but it takes us years to prop up a business. And I think that is both sides of the aisle understand that businesses are critical to the tax base in our state here. And so I just ask that you support this bill. What we are looking for is that we hope that there are four measures that are addressed. First, we want to prioritize grants so businesses can stabilize without taking on more debt. Second, we want to ensure flexibility in funds so they can be used for rent, payroll, and day-to-day operations. Each business is different, and we will need that flexibility to make this work. Third, please keep access simple with streamlined applications that are broadly broad eligibility. And fourth, to move resources quickly through local governments and trusted partners like foundations. This is a targeted, fiscally responsible response focused on short-term stabilization during an acute disruption. In closing, I just want to say that this business impact, this is a short-term shock with the potential for long-term damage if we do not act. And that the faster we stabilize small businesses, the faster we stabilize our communities. And so with that, I just want to say again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I wish you all good luck with the rest of this session.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Up next, we have Georgia Gallardo. Please come up. She's on Zoom. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, members of the committee. Dear Chair Fraser and Chair Tolkison, my name is Georgia Gallardo, and I'm representing Carcoven Contributor. Thank you for your attention to this matter. We would like to emphasize that enforcement has not only impacted the metro areas of Minneapolis and St. Paul, but also significantly affect those who of us who operate a small business in rural communities. My husband Thomas and I own Carcoven Contributor, a small meat processing facility in Carcoven, Minnesota, near Wilmer, Minnesota. I came to this country from Venezuela 35 years ago, and my husband came from Cuba 31 years ago. We started Carcoven Contributor in 2019, got our first license of custom butchering in early 2020. Our Equa2 license, which allows us to produce and process meat and poultry products for wholesale within the state. We are also a halal processor. We specialize in sheep, goat, beef, and deer. In starting our business, we have helped our farmers. We got help from our farmers, neighbors, and helped us to get our permits and build our meat shop. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture helped us with a small meat and poultry processing grant, and their inspection division guided us to how to comply with the rules of meat safety. And additionally, we have worked with Mr. Paul Sobosensky of Minnesota Farmers Union solving the local meat processing bottleneck project. Our meat is sold locally in Wilmer and also St. Cloud, Minnesota. Meat processing support farmers in our local communities. Operation Metro Search significantly hurt rural Minnesota communities. Because of ICE, our small meat processing plant had a reduction in sales to our main retail outlets of about $6,500. And additionally, our weekend traffic from immigrants from friends and neighbors who will often stop by on our processing plant significantly declined, costing us $5,350. Our customers were afraid to come out. This strengthened our ability to stay in business and serve the community we love so deeply. Chair Fraser and Chair Talkinson, we simply love this country. Our ability to start this business will only be a dream in a, from the countries that we came from. We urge this committee to provide relief and support to the small business across the state we negatively impact by ICE. And thank you, Chair Fraser and Chair Talkinson, for already sponsoring a bill supporting relief and for the opportunity to share our story. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for their testimony. Up next, we have David Campana from the Council of Latino Affairs. I think you're also on Zoom.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Fraser, Chair Talkinson, and community members, committee members. My name is David Campana, Legislative and Policy Director in Economic Development for the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, MCLA. The Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs is a state agency that advises and informs the state legislature and government on issues relevant to our diverse Latino communities. The Council wishes to add the many voices presented today with particular emphasis on the urgent need to support Latino small businesses, workers, and families in Minnesota who have been disproportionately impacted by the recent immigration enforcement surge. Toward that support, we offer the following data points. Latino small businesses are a vital and growing part of Minnesota's economy. Minnesota is home to at least 1,700 Latino-owned businesses supporting approximately 17,000 jobs. Those are in addition to the more than 10,000 self-employed Latino entrepreneurs. Recent reports show that Latino businesses have experienced sharp declines in economic activity, with many reporting drops in sales of 40% to 90% as workers and customers stay home due to fear and uncertainty. Between August and November of 2025, months before the immigration surge, MCLA surveyed more than 250 Latino Minnesotans. In that survey, respondents' results indicated that employment at 38% and small business needs at 28% were main areas of concern. When asked what they could fix, if anything, 20% said the climate for small businesses. We have learned of the difficulties that Latino small businesses experience in accessing the financial support needed to preserve and sustain their operations. And we have heard these businesses don't want to hang out. They just want to contribute to the vibrancy of their communities as they always have through hard work. Thank you for your time and attention to this important matter.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Up next, we have Brooklyn Park Police Chief Mark Brule, who I believe is also on Zoom.
Thank you, Chair Fraser, and good morning, members of the committee. I am Brooklyn Park Police Chief Mark Brule. I've served in law enforcement for 30 years. What you will not hear from me today is that we should abolish ICE. Federal immigration enforcement is an integral part of our national security, and I have a long and productive history of working closely with federal agents, some of the finest men and women I have been around. What we saw during Operation Metro Surge, particularly in late December and January, was not the federal partnership I have known for three decades. During the surge, police officers and civilian employees across the state began reporting being stopped in traffic or on the street without cause for what appeared to be solely because of the color of their skin. In one specific example, a Brooklyn Park officer was stopped by unidentified federal agents. The officer had their child in the vehicle with them and simply driven past the federal agents and made contact with them. The federal agents stopped the off-duty officer by boxing their vehicle. They wore no insignia beyond generic police markings, provided no identification, and concealed their faces. When the officer attempted to record the encounter, agents knocked the phone from their hands. Federal agents had guns drawn and only left after the officer identified themselves as a Brooklyn Park police officer. I can only imagine how many residents had the same experience but had no badge to protect them. I am not here because it's my employees that were being stopped. I'm speaking out because my employees know the rules. They understand policing, the Constitution, and the legal guidelines within which we operate. When they come to me with fear in their eyes and anger in their voice, telling me they believe they were targeted for no other reason than the color of their skin, I felt the need to sound the alarm. Every mechanism of accountability we relied upon in the past was broken or missing. Agents were not wearing name tags. They covered their faces and lacked body cameras. When they wore vests labeled police, the public believed it was us. The trust that local police departments have worked diligently over the past 6 years to build eroded in a matter of weeks. These federal actions came with a real financial cost. Since we started tracking in January, Brooklyn Park has incurred an estimated cost of $24,000 due to ICE-related activities. That's just the cost of overtime spent responding to large incidents. It says nothing for the many untracked costs and staff time responding to the reports of federal activity, fulfilling data requests, and managing concerns through community meetings. For a city of our size, every overtime dollar spent responding to federal operations is a dollar not spent on local public safety needs our residents depend on, such as responding to calls, investigating crimes, and maintaining the community policing presence that keeps neighborhoods safe. We must focus our limited resources on local priorities, not absorb the costs of unsupervised federal agents. Beyond the public safety related costs, Brooklyn Park has incurred over $600,000 in additional costs, including $300,000 in rental assistance and $270,000 in small business support. These emergency measures help prevent displacement and closures, but they are not a substitute for sustained recovery. These actions are representative of the Cities for Safe and Stable Communities, which Brooklyn Park is a member, a nonpartisan coalition of 33 Minnesota cities united to restore economic stability, local governance, and the public trust in the wake of Operation Metro Surge. Finally, I would like to share that I have seen the best of what the federal government has to offer. I worked alongside federal agents in the tragic assassination investigation of Speaker Melissa Hortman this past summer. What happened during Operation Metro Surge was not coordination. Our communities deserve accountability, proper supervision, and federal operations on local streets and assurance that constitutional rights will be upheld. I respectfully ask this committee to help ensure that that happens. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief Brule. Up next will be Leanne Rasicek. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Frazier, Chair Torkelson, and members of the committee. My name is Leanne Rasicek, and I'm CEO of Women Venture. We are a community development financial institution, CDFI. And I'm also board chair of the Minnesota CDFI Coalition. It represents 35 CDFIs focused on small business and housing. I'm here today in strong support of House File 4477 and the establishment of a targeted small business relief program. What we are experiencing is not a normal economic downturn. It is a convergence of pressures unlike anything we have seen or felt our entrepreneurs have faced before, and it's accelerating. Across Minnesota, businesses that were stable, growing, and contributing to vibrant main streets are now navigating compounding disruption. We are seeing the impacts of unprecedented federal law enforcement that is destabilizing workforce participation and altering customer behavior in real time. We are seeing tariffs increase the cost of goods, materials, and inventory, forcing small business owners to either absorb margin loss or pass costs on to those customers who are already stretched. And today, global instability is driving up fuel, transportation, and basic need costs, raising the baseline cost of doing business across Minnesota. These are not isolated challenges, they are compounding forces. And for small businesses operating on thin margins, compounding pressure does not create inconvenience, it creates a crisis. We are hearing this directly from entrepreneurs across the state. In the first few weeks of January, CDFI has heard from hundreds of small businesses requesting urgent financial and technical support in response to federal law enforcement impacting their workforce and foot traffic. One of our Women Venture clients, who's celebrating 20 years in business, employing more than 60 people, was on track for double-digit revenue growth coming into 2026. Instead, her employees were sheltering in place through March. They were losing $3,000 to $5,000 every day as she was ensuring that they had her employees' food on the table, rent was paid, and they were safe. Another business owner who has a rapidly growing national child care franchise with locations across Minnesota experienced ICE agents outside of their child care centers. Their presence outside a Spanish immersion child care center, where Spanish-speaking educators care for children every day, sent a message to their staff. You are being watched. And that kind of fear doesn't stay in the parking lot, it follows people home. Every member of their team is legally authorized to work in the United States. They've used E-Verify since 2019. And still that fear persists. My personal story. As a US-born citizen, conducting a business lunch meeting in early January in the beloved Rondo neighborhood, a black truck pulls up, out-of-state plates, and I see three figures watching me while I conduct business. I'm not afraid of my own safety. We've gone through that protocol before. We have a policy in place at Women Venture if something should happen to me. Our family has had conversations about what to do if I get detained for no reason at all. I'm afraid for the people who are in that restaurant who are working there. So I ask you to believe our stories. Businesses that were on track for growth are now facing sudden and significant cost increases due to tariffs and rising fuel costs, often with no ability to renegotiate supplier contracts. We are seeing owners delay hiring, reduce hours, and pause expansion. Construction projects that were well underway have now been stopped. Not because demand has disappeared, because uncertainty has taken hold. And across communities statewide, the pattern is consistent. Revenue is down, costs are up, confidence is shaken. And we have already seen the data. I'm grateful that North Star Policy was here today. They released research estimating $626 million drop in consumer spending across our state in January 2026 alone, 2.8% drop in unemployment, $106 million in lost wages, and the first 6 weeks of 2026. We're still gathering data. We don't know what the economic total result is going to be yet, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. So I want to be clear that this is not a metro only issue. From Worthington to St. Cloud, from Rochester to Duluth, small businesses across Minnesota are experiencing the same pressures. Last week, our team at Women Venture hosted 15 child care providers in Willmar. We provided training in digital marketing and held space for community. They have been directly impacted by the compounding factors that no one asked for and continue to navigate instability while children and parents are losing ground on development and work, respectively. CDFIs are on the front line of this moment. We are the economic first responders. We are restructuring loans, extending terms, and working side by side with entrepreneurs to stabilize their business. But we are not designed to absorb systemic shocks of this magnitude by ourselves. And that is why House File 4477 is so critical. It represents a strategic, timely intervention that meets this moment. Bless you. It provides the framework for a business relief program that can deliver flexible, responsive capital to entrepreneurs who need it most, before temporary disruption becomes permanent closure. It recognizes that early investment is far less costly than rebuilding after widespread business loss. This positions Minnesota to respond not just to this moment, but to do so in a way that preserves a long-term economic strength for our state. And without intervention, the consequences are clear. Business closure, job loss, erosion of our tax base, and long-term damage to the economic vitality of our communities. This is where leadership matters. This is where leadership is strategic, understanding the cost of inaction. So I ask for your support. This is economic strategy, and this is the work of our time. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and also for sharing your personal story. I appreciate that. Up next, we have Dr. Brenda Lewis from Fridley Public Schools. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, co-chairs and committee members. My name is Brenda Lewis, superintendent of Fridley Public Schools. Fridley Public Schools is proud to serve just under 2,800 students. Our district is 80% students of color. 72% of our students come from families living in poverty, and 20% of our students are multilingual learners. We're heavy East African and heavy West African and heavy Hispanic Latino. You can see from the demographics I gave why we likely became a target of ICE Metro surge. Since December, our highest number that we had was we've lost 112 students for enrollment. So at the highest, we had 112 students that were with us in December that were not with us. We've come back now, and we still have 72 students that are not with us. Where are those students? They've gone to districts that weren't targets of ICE Metro surge, which as a mom, I can completely understand that, as well as an educator. They've also left the country. They've moved out of state. And some are still being held in deportation facilities. We also don't know where some of our students are as well. At our height of virtual enrollment, we had 423 students enrolled in virtual learning because they were not safe to come to our school district. We are doing better, and now we have just under 100 enrolled in virtual. Fridley Public Schools did not have a virtual learning program prior to ICE Metro surge, and we stood that up in under 4 days. When you look at our enrollment impacts, this is looking at well over $1 million tied directly to our enrollment. At the same time, our expenditures have increased. When you think about our cost for virtual, we're at $80,000 and rising for virtual. We have $138,000 lost in student nutrition reimbursement. When children are not eating breakfast and lunch on site in a public school district, we are unable to get that reimbursement. When you look at as well, this compiled with a loss of nearly $1.5 million in compensatory ed revenue for our district, absent a hold harmless or a fix, these expenditures pile up. I also do not have figures for you today on what our recovery will look like. What is the recovery around academic learning loss? More importantly, what is the recovery around our social and emotional learning, both for our children and for our staff from what we have been through? Our current reality, like many districts, our revenue is just decreasing, our costs are increasing, our student need is increasing. I'm not here today about policy debate. This is about the operational ability and stability to run not only my school system, but school systems across Minnesota. This is not a manageable equation for any district. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, we have Mary Granlin. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you so much, excuse me, Chair Frazier and Chair Torkelson for inviting me here to speak, and also thank you to the committee. I am Mary Granlin. I am School Board Chair of Columbia Heights Public Schools. Our district includes Southern Fridley, Hilltop, and of course Columbia Heights. Our school district community looks largely the same as it did 100 years ago when it was first founded. A hardworking immigrant community who cares deeply about their families and their neighbors. Our school district is scrappy and careful with our finances. However, due to our small size, we often don't have the business tax base that many other districts have. Ensuring our businesses not only survive but thrive is not just good for the business owners and employees, but it's imperative for our school districts and our communities as a whole, especially our school districts as when we don't have businesses to rely on, we end up relying on the tax base of our homeowners. My superintendent has been saying for a while now that the surge has impacted our students in three separate layers. Those who were detained and are displaying various trauma responses. Those who were sequestered at home for months and learning online. And those who were not in danger of being apprehended, but still afraid and saw their classmates missing. They may say the surge is over, but we will continue to see the impact and devastation for years to come. In fact, we continue to see it daily
in our hallways when children cling to their sibling in passing. To the parents and family members who eye every single suspicious looking SUV as it goes through the community. And to the family members who were once cleared to legally work in our country, but have returned from their unlawful detention wearing ankle monitors as if legally following the asylum process somehow makes them criminals. Again, the fiscal impact of the surge does not just impact our businesses. When businesses close, schools lose that important tax base. And again, those costs shift to our homeowners. And our communities are less bright without those businesses there. As a working class community, we cannot continue to shift that cost burden onto homeowners. Additionally, we cannot continue to cut classes. We need the legislature to support efforts to ease these burdens placed on our communities. And let me be clear, we had successfully budgeted the mandates from the legislature. The financial impact from the surge eclipses that. We are down $1 million, approximately, you know, just over 100 students. And that $1 million, coupled with the compensatory aid, we are looking at the loss of somewhere around, let me put this in real person terms for everybody here. That loss looks like letting go of 40 teachers. How big is 40 teachers in a school district of 3,300 students? That is equivalent to an entire elementary school. Now, let me be clear, we are also not looking at closing an elementary school. Just let me get ahead of that one. But I think it's really important for everybody to recognize the real value and cost that we are looking at. And that is before, again, as was mentioned, the lifelong impact of these detentions on our students who will grow up to be business owners. And without this support, they may not feel like they can. Thank you.
Thank you for coming here and bringing the experiences and voices of your community. Up next, we have Mike Seifert. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Frazier and Chair Torkelson and the committee members for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Mike Seifert. I'm a fourth-generation family farmer that runs a small, diversified row crop operation just south of Jordan. I'm here today on behalf of Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization that has represented family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities since 1918. I appreciate the opportunity to share some of the insight into what MFU has heard from our members and from others about the impacts of Operation Metro Surge. To begin with, and to state it plainly, Operation Metro Surge has had impacts far beyond the Metro, and those impacts will continue to be felt for a long time. In the hope that it will inform this committee's work, I'll share some of those impacts that we've heard from our members. First, I think it's important to state that we have farmers, MFU members, and others who were concerned for their own safety and that of their families. We heard stories about immigrant farmers who grow specialty crops who weren't showing up to farmers' markets to the extent that some of those markets saw a significant loss of business, both due to lack of vendors and lack of customers. Some of those same specialty crop growers were questioning whether they should even buy seed for the upcoming year because these folks don't necessarily live where they farm, and they didn't know whether they could feel safe traveling back and forth from their homes to their farms. In Minnesota, we're proud of the fact that we bucked national trends by adding more new farmers this last agricultural census, and that's been a great thing for our community. And in part, that's been through focusing on supporting emerging farmers. Second, many farmers rely on workers who are afraid to travel or even leave their homes for the first months of this year. It's important to note that Minnesota's agricultural industry is already struggling with a tight labor market from production all the way to processing. In production, we heard about dairy farmers who were driving their workers to and from work because those workers were afraid to be out and driving alone. And that's despite those workers having legal authorization to be here and to work here. In processing, we've heard about plant shutdowns reminiscent of COVID-19. We heard from one member who was about to load his livestock when he got a call that they were shutting down the processing facility for the day because ice was spotted in the community and enough workers didn't show up to their shift so that they needed to idle the plant. We heard from another member whose colleagues were followed home after their shift at a small meat processor. And we know that just over 40% of livestock processing employees in this state are immigrants. So this all put pressure on an industry at a time when we need more people to decide to start a career in meat cutting and to take over generational processing plants. I'll also say that as farmers who produce corn and soybeans, we rely on these workers too. And although I don't have employees myself on my farm, much of the grain that I grow goes on to feed livestock and thereby makes its way down the chain to facets of our agricultural industry, which do rely on immigrant labor. Just another example of a disruption in processing is that we heard from another member who's working on building a food processing facility in his region. In the early months of this year, the workers contracted to build the facility asked to be moved to another job or to be housed across the border and to travel in from a neighboring state. Third, many local restaurants, including those that purchase from local farmers, have felt the impacts of ice in Minnesota. For months, many of these community businesses had to close out of fear or because they saw dramatic reductions in customers who feared leaving their homes. For agriculture, the impacts are coming amidst an ongoing crisis in farm country caused by a perfect storm of low crop prices, higher input costs, and trade uncertainty. And one big fear is that people will decide they just don't want to come and work in Minnesota. To close, like many Minnesotans, I felt the impacts close to home. I know of at least 24 families in our local community that are still relying on mutual aid to get groceries and other necessities, first because they were too fearful to leave their homes, and now because the loss of income is causing them to rely on that aid for their basic needs. And like so many Minnesotans, I have a daughter in middle school, and my wife and I and other parents in our community have had to have difficult conversations with our kids about why their classmates couldn't show up for school, or why some of those classmates were living with the fear that their parents would go to work and simply not come home at the end of the day. I think as a community, we know that this isn't right, and I appreciate the legislature considering what we can do as a state to help. I hope my remarks today have helped shed some more light on the economic impacts in agriculture and rural communities across the state, and of course, this is just some of what we heard from Farmers Union members this year. I appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Seifert, apologies for mispronouncing your name the first time, but thank you for being here and thank you for providing those stories from your communities. Up next, we'll have Mayor Jacob Frey. Welcome, Mr. Mayor.
Well, over here. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Chairs, members of the committee, it's really an honor to be here with you. My name is Jacob Frey. I'm the mayor of Minneapolis, and I am here to speak in favor of finding ways to get additional monies to Minneapolis, recognizing everything that has occurred through Operation Metro Surge. While Operation Metro Surge has indeed wound down in Minneapolis, we're not out of the woods yet. The ramifications, having thousands of federal agents deployed to Minneapolis streets, having to undergo significant overtime costs, small and local business closures, revenue decreases have had an incredible impact on our city. In February, we released a preliminary impact analysis. That impact analysis was conducted by our emergency management department at the city, and it showed that we were having damages to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, $203 million in total worth of impact to our city collectively. That's $47 million worth of lost wages, $81 million worth of impact to small local businesses, specifically restaurants, between $10 and $20 million per week in small and local business impact. To the city specifically, we saw $6 million worth of overtime costs, and that was just to police alone in 1 month. That runs through virtually our entire overtime budget just in the span of a number of weeks. $5 million worth of hotel cancellations, and that does not include some of the lost conventions that we got thereafter, and about 76,000 people who have experiencing some form of food insecurity. And so the impacts have been staggering. Chair Frazier, thank you so much for your work on this particular topic. When the Twin Cities or Minneapolis experiences this kind of damage, it impacts the whole state. We want to rejuvenate our economic tax base. We want businesses to open. We want to be able to provide tax revenue to the rest of the state so that small towns and cities throughout Minnesota have the ability to pay for their basic needs, roads and bridges, social services. But to make sure that that flame is reignited, we also need help in getting through this difficult time now. Recovery begins now. As we know, for every $3 that Minneapolis provides in tax revenue, we get one back. And we're proud, again, to help small towns and cities throughout the state. We can operate as a team here in Minnesota. And at the same time, we need help getting through this period now. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for having me. I'm also happy to stand for any questions that you may have.
Mr. Mayor, we've got like two more testifiers. We'll get through those. Yes, if you could hang out, we do have some questions for you. But
of course, thank you.
Thank you. Up next is Macy Herr. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Macy Herr. I am the owner of St. Juan Restaurant and Banquet Hall. Sorry, everyone. This business is just not a place to eat. It is my life. It is my family's future. It is years of sacrifice, long nights, and hard work. It is a place where our community feels at home. We have always done everything right. We have been a good tenant. We pay our rent. We follow the rules. We show up every single day, and we work so hard to keep our doors open. But during December and January, everything changed because of ICE activities in our community. Fear took over. Our customers stopped coming. Family were too afraid to go out. Our dining room, once full of laughter and life, became quiet. Imagine working your whole life to build something and then watching it slowly empty out. Not because you fail, but because people are scared. And while we were struggling, while we were trying to survive, we were just expected to pay everything in full. Not understanding, no compassion, just pressure. We are not asking for special treatment. We are asking for humanity. Small business owners like me are being impacted by things completely out of our control. And when that happens, we should not be left alone to carry all the weight. State investment in small businesses, it would mean hope. It would mean that people like me don't lose everything. We work so hard to build. I am standing here not just for myself, but for many small business owners who are hurting in silence. Please, please hear us. Please hear us, and please stand with us. Thank you.
Ms. Hur, thank you. I understand how difficult it is to tell this story, and I appreciate your courage, and thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Up next, we have J.D. Delgado. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairs, members of this committee, members of our community, my name is J.D. Delgado. I work in the Lakeville Public Schools as a school liaison. I coach kids for over 25 years. My wife and I own a small business. I am a proud American citizen, and I have been here for 35 years. I love this country and the opportunity I have. I need to start something that probably isn't in any of your reports. Empty desks. The first thing I noticed as a public school liaison was the empty desk. Kids I knew by name, kids I watched grow up, just gone. No explanation, no call. Use empty chairs where children used to sit. So I reach out to their families because that's what you do when kids disappear. You go find out why. What I found, I wasn't prepared for. Fear, that is specific, ongoing, justified fear of federal employees. This is not a footnote. It is the whole story. When the people who are supposed to protect you are the people you are hiding from, something has gone very, very wrong in this country. These are not rumors. These are people I sat with, people who made me coffee and asked me what they did wrong. And I had to look them in the eye and tell them they didn't do anything wrong. The closest I can get to what it feels like is grief. No sadness, grief. The kind that comes when you love something and you feel it is slipping away. Now let me tell you what this costs our economy. And I can tell you this not just as a school liaison, but as a small business owner. My wife and I run a restaurant. Hispanic workers came in for lunch on weekends, weekdays and weekends. Reliable. Week after week, good people, hard workers, people I knew by name, they stopped coming in. Not because anything changed about our food or services, they stopped coming in because they were afraid to leave their homes. I track what that cost for us. From December 15 through March 15, 12 weeks, Alberta's lost an estimated $36,000 in revenue. $3,000 a week gone. For a small business, $36,000 is a mountain to overcome. I myself had to take out money from my 401k just to stay afloat. We made the decision to keep paying our employees. We were not going to let our workers bear the cost of something that was done to them. My wife and I took less home. We cut from ourselves before we cut from everyone else. And then we gave the little we had left to families in our communities who had nothing, families who were hiding, who could not work, who needed groceries and could not leave their homes to get them. We bought those groceries. We knocked on some doors. I want this committee to understand that is what neighbors do, but it deepened the financial strain of us considerable. And we were not alone. Across this district, ordinary people were quietly absorbing costs that this government created. Not every small business could do what we did. Some had to stop paying employees altogether. Workers who were already afraid to leave their home lost their paychecks, too. And it is something that's not shown in any report. The search official ended in mid-February, but my customers did not come back until March 15. 4 weeks after enforcement stopped, the fear was still keeping people inside. The terror outlasted the operation. The ACLU has more than 24 sworn affidavits. The Associated Press document the pattern nationally. I didn't need either of them to tell me what I already saw. I saw in the empty desk. I'm not here to say that lawful enforcement is wrong. I believe in order. I believe in equal justice. I believe people who committed crime should face consequences. I am standing here to say what happened in our community was not enforcement. Enforcement does not put a knee on a child's neck at a bus stop. And enforcement does not make an entire community of working, tax-paying, child-raising human beings disappear from the economy. This committee has the responsibility to ask what that costs, not just in dollars, but in who we are. Because the American that I love, the one that so many come here for, does not make people afraid to
Mr. Delgado,
open their doors.
I am going to have to ask you to wrap. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. I appreciate that comments. We have one last testifier, Alexandra Fitzsimmons. Please come to the desk. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Frazier and members of the committee. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. And despite my last name, I am a second-generation Italian-American. Thank you for the opportunity to share how Operation Metro Surge has affected the well-being of Minnesota children. This book, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, is Goodnight Moon. It's a book many parents and caregivers read to their children before bed. Children find comfort in looking around their room and naming what is familiar and what is safe. Goodnight room, goodnight moon. It's about routine, predictability, and the quiet reassurance that everything and everyone will still be there in the morning. During Operation Metro Surge, many children in Minnesota lost that sense of safety. CDF Minnesota submitted an amicus brief on behalf of Minnesota children in State v. Nome. As we stated in our brief, children experienced this operation as fear. They saw masked armed agents in their neighborhoods, near their schools, and outside their homes. They watched parents and caregivers detained during everyday moments on the way to school, at bus stops, and in their own driveways. Some children were detained themselves. Others were left not knowing if their caregiver would come home. For many children, bedtime no longer came with reassurance. It came with uncertainty. And for many of these children, especially those children who came to Minnesota as asylees or refugees, this was not the first time they experienced that kind of fear. Many had already experienced trauma in their home countries, then again when they were forced to leave, again during the journey here, and now in what was supposed to be their place of safety, their new home, they experienced it again. This matters because research is clear. Repeated exposure to trauma causes substantial harm. Decades of research on adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, show that experiences like family separation, community violence, chronic fear, and instability accumulate. They create toxic stress, which disrupts brain development and increases the risks of lifelong health, learning, and mental health challenges. And we know the economic cost. A 2023 study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Network Open found that ACE-related health conditions, cost $14.1 trillion annually in the United States, or about $88,000 per person per year, and up to $2.4 million over a lifetime. These costs are highest for individuals exposed to repeated trauma, exactly what many children experienced here in Minnesota. Children missed school because families were afraid to leave their homes. As you already heard many times today, attendance dropped. Families withdrew from work, childcare, and healthcare, and the routines that anchor childhood disappeared. At the same time, children were witnessing arrests and experiencing family separation. We will continue to see those costs in our childcare settings, in our schools, healthcare systems, workforce, and communities for years to come. Importantly, these impacts did not end when Operation Metro Surge ended. Children continue to carry anxiety, instability, and fear, and the economic and developmental consequences continue to unfold. But the greatest cost is not captured in any budget. The greatest cost is to childhood. Our children's childhoods were interrupted by the loss of safety in the places that should have protected them, and that is something we cannot replace. But there is hope. Research shows children can heal when they have stable relationships and access to supports. Investments in early intervention, mental health care, school-based services, and family stability can help reduce long-term harm and strengthen outcomes and help ensure our children can still find wonder and joy in their childhoods. Children should be able to say goodnight and trust that their world is safe and that the people they love will still be there in the morning and again at night. Thank you for your time and your commitment to Minnesota's children.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our list of testifiers. Just a moment. That includes our list of testifiers. Members, we will now open it up for questions. First on the list is Coach Chair Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. I was wondering if Mayor Frey could come back to the table. And also, is Mayor Herr still here?
Mr. Mayor, please come up.
Okay, she's not here. Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know that Mayor Herr asked me if she thought people would ask her questions, and so it's my fault she's not here. She said she had other meetings.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Chair Moeller. I will say I think we all know how to find Mayor Herr. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Chair Baker.
Passes, but that's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mayor, welcome again. It's good to see you. I've always appreciated our conversations regarding the biggest and the most amazing city in the state of Minnesota. I really appreciate all that you do there and the tough job you really have amongst your policymakers. It's insane because it's trying to balance out business growth in an area and decisions that are very expensive in Minnesota when we relate it to other places in Minnesota. Again, my question to you is, you were in the committee last week with us with Co-Chair Pinto. Thank you for being there, talking directly about House File 4477, looking really for the dollars. We don't really have that in front of us today. You made a statement last week, though, that was sort of like Minneapolis was still struggling economically prior to Metro Surge, trying to get actually, I think it was after just the COVID and all the unrest and things. What did you specifically mean by that? What is causing, do you think, your ability to kind of get back on and get things moving forward? What did you mean by that?
Mayor Frey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, while I don't have the exact testimony that I gave last week here in front of me, I imagine what I was referencing was a fiscal concern that we have at the city of Minneapolis, given a devaluation of significant downtown commercial buildings. When a larger building, previously holding a large number of office tenants, sells for 50 cents on the dollar, the impact is a lesser amount of property taxes that we're able to collect from it. We still need to get those revenues, and the burden ends up going towards residents. I imagine that's what I was referencing. This is not an issue that is at all unique to Minneapolis. Most significant cities throughout the country are seeing this same exact issue. We are acting in the immediacy to change the dynamic, switching substantially to entertainment in downtown, more residential. Buildings are being converted rapidly in some form, and so that's the antidote to some of the concerns that I mentioned.
Chair Beck, can you follow
up? Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a couple questions, not necessarily all for Mayor Frey, just some comments too. But Mayor, also, and I know during Minneapolis, there was a lot of overtime because of Metro Surge to the police department specifically. I assume you're tracking that. One of the things that, well, do you know roughly where that might be at this time with the dollar amount for the police overtime? And if you don't, it's I understand you weren't asked about this ahead of time.
Mayor Frey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, following Metro Surge, we were looking at somewhere in the range of $6 million worth of overtime from our police department. That overtime was necessary because we had somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 ICE agents and Border Patrol that were on our streets causing quite a bit of chaos. And our police officers need to not just respond to 911 calls when they are short-staffed, but they also needed to make sure that crime scenes, shootings, including those by ICE, were secured so that we can conduct a full and fair investigation. We needed to make sure that there was peace in the streets and order that was significantly debilitated during that portion of time throughout our city due to Operation Metro Surge.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Chair Baker.
Thank you. And thank you for that. Again, I have heard, I don't have any specific numbers too. I've also heard with a lot of our large cities and even the state of Minnesota, I'm still looking for information back on the overtime cost too, because this all seems to add up on really the government-imposed Metro Surge or government-imposed mandates like paid family medical leave. I want to bring it up. I'm the chair of the committee. I want to make sure that we talk about this issue openly because it's all about government imposing things on our businesses that we rely on to bring us the jobs and bring us the entertainment venues that you're trying to talk about. Again, I have only heard this, and again, you don't maybe have this, but do you know the overtime costs right now of paid family to the Minneapolis Police Department specifically? Because it's, again, it's revolving around this government-imposed mandates and surges. I just want to know, do you happen to have that? And if you don't, I understand.
But Mr. Mayor, we didn't expect you to come here prepared for that.
Right.
If you'd like to provide that to Chair Baker, you can send that information to him. I would like to stick to the topic, which almost everyone here has testified to, was the impact of Metro Surge. Mr. Chair Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, I don't have that information before me. Thank you, though.
And fair enough. Again, this is government-imposed stuff on business, so we're not going to get away from that today. Again, I have been talking about this for several years here. Again, we are a better state when Minneapolis thrives. Same thing with St. Paul. I am not happy with what happened with Metro Surge. I am not going to sit here and say this wasn't poorly executed. There was a lot of emotions. There was a lot of leaders that said a lot of things that I wish that hadn't been said. But you know what? We have this now in front of us. And Minnesota does need relief. Minnesota businesses need relief. Ms. Herr that spoke passionately about her business. As a small business person myself, I know the blood, sweat, and tears that you put into this. I know what the chief did, and I think it was St. Louis Park or Brooklyn Center.
Brooklyn Park.
Brooklyn Park, thank you. I get that. A lot of trust was lost in a matter of weeks when they were building this stuff up. We're on the same Minnesota team here. And I think that what I want to make sure I ask, and my final question is just, what is the city of Minneapolis doing? Because as we as a body look at statewide policies and how can we help, how can we either find dollars or write better policy that kind of comes together to support your businesses, what is the so far, if there's any, what has the city of Minneapolis done so far?
Yes.
If they've made any motions, resolutions to actually help either reduce the cost of business or have they done anything with licensing fees or other temporary pauses? Can you share with us what you have done at your authority level, Mr. Mayor?
Mayor Frey.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Baker, thank you for the question. In direct response to Operation Metro Surge, the City of Minneapolis has contributed approximately $7 million to bringing small businesses back. That is in the form of grants. That's in the form mainly of activations along corridors that we're trying to drive additional patrons. That's in the form of breaks in fees, taxes, license and permits fees specifically. And we hope that that reduction in cost will also allow these small and local businesses to take the next steps to open their doors, to run advertisements, to get more and more people out to them. In addition to that, we're undergoing substantial and rigorous permitting and licensing reform to ensure that the process of opening a business is streamlined as possible, and we're working with a get-to-yes attitude throughout our administration. You know, that work is ongoing, we hope that we're going to have some clear additional actions that take place on it in the near future.
Chair Baker, any follow-up?
Final, Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you for that. I have no more questions, but I think it's just, I wanted to just point out today about the actions that were real, that did happen, again, both federally and statewide, that we are all making decisions that are not always business friendly. Our state of Minnesota is not in the right place to be known as a business friendly state. We are losing folks, not only out of Minneapolis, out of large tenants out of Minneapolis, but we're losing them out of the entire state because of how this state has sort of forgotten where our golden nugget is. Our franchise, our headquarter companies, our restaurants, we saw the report last week from Hospitality Minnesota that they're really under a lot of fear. And you know that. You've made those comments before, too, that those are the most susceptible businesses in our state. The Nicollet Mall isn't anything like it used to be, and we all want to see that come back to life like it was. There was an interesting article today in the Minneapolis Star-Tribune about the opinion page. Minneapolis didn't just decline overnight. It's been a slow trickle, but Metro Surge put it all up in front of us, and now's our chance to look at everything. Now's our chance to do what our businesses really need us to do, and that's get good with maybe licensing reform, maybe what are we charging for liquor costs, liquor fees, liquor, all those things. Again, being in the business, that's super important. The franchise fees in Minneapolis are 5.25% to 6%. The sales tax in Minneapolis is 9%. They're for different reasons, and I think there's talk about maybe raising it some more to help out other things. Costs really do matter, folks. That's all I'm saying. And we need to do a better job in Minnesota to be more actively engaged in making sure that our businesses are healthy and vibrant and sustainable before these kinds of events, whether it's a weather-related event, electric outage event, those are going to be devastating. And what we can't have is folks come to us and the rest of the taxpayers when we haven't given them the good tools ahead of time to succeed. That's my only comment to this surge, but I'm worried about Operation Job Loss Surge later on, that we're not going to kind of see a surge, but it's going to be a trickle. And in 5 or 10 years, the state will not look the same. So, members, I appreciate being here today. I want to say thank you to all the businesses that came forward and the great testimony that they have. I feel it. I lost a couple of housekeepers during this whole Metro Surge thing that had to leave the state for a while and they came back. I get it. And I want to do everything I can to make it right, but we also have to get much more thoughtful on how we can become a better business state in this beautiful land that we live in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate you sharing your personal impact, but also I do appreciate that you noted that we're going to be looking at Operation Job Loss Surge, and we will if we don't do anything. So I appreciate that. Right. Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor Fry, for being with us today. It's good to see you here at the Capitol. I know that your work has been challenging and will continue to be just as ours is. One of the things you mentioned was the police overtime issue, and I'm just asking for really an update on the situation with the Minneapolis Police Force. How are you doing on hiring? Are you anywhere near the capacity for police officers that's been designated by you and your city council? And also, if you could touch on the training aspects for your police officers.
Mayor Fry.
Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Torkelson, we are netting substantially positive right now in the numbers of police officers that are coming on to join the Minneapolis Police Department. Last I checked, applications were up somewhere in the range of 110%. We were seeing significant numbers come on both as community service officers, as laterals, as cadets, and as recruits. We are in the mid low to mid 600s right now in terms of the number of officers that we have. Netting substantially positive. Right now, our police department is the most diverse it has ever been in our city's history, and officers are joining because they want to both be the change in this department, and they want to protect and serve people throughout our city. They care deeply about safety. I am hopeful that by the end of next year, we will be well above 700, and the numbers should be increasing from there. So we're making good progress, and I'll just note that obviously there is a direct correlation between the number of officers that we have and the overtime costs that we have seen.
Chair Torkelson, any follow-up?
Just briefly, and so do you offhand remember where you were at with police officers during the Metro surge time?
Virtually the same, a little
Mr.
bit.
Mr. Mayor.
I apologize. Mr. Chair, Co-Chair Torkelson, we haven't seen like a huge influx of officers in the last month, if that's what you're asking. We go through a number of training and onboarding of officers usually a few times per year, and so no, we have not seen a significant shift since then. But again, it's continued to tick up.
Well, thank you,
Chair.
Thank you, Mayor Fry, for being with us today. We appreciate your input. We look forward to working with you as we move through the rest of this session, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you. I don't think we have more questions for you. Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just ask if Dr. Lewis and Chair Granlin could come up. I just want to
Go ahead, Chair Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have questions for these two ladies, but I just really want to say how proud of you guys I am. I am utterly grateful to represent Spring Lake Park, Fridley, Hilltop, and Columbia Heights. And we probably talked more over this past winter. I mean, Mary and I were talking every day. We saw in our community, in the restaurant down the street from my house, a brand new Mexican restaurant just starting up, and they had to lock their doors so that they could protect their workers. So if you're ever in Spring Lake Park, Frida's, go there. We sat in the parking lot at Central Plaza just to make sure people could go into the Loma Bonita supermarket or to go to the laundromat. We followed buses home from school in Columbia Heights just so that families felt safe. My kid goes to Woodcrest, which is a Spanish immersion school in Fridley. We walked kids home from there, from Woodcrest, into the Fridley Terraces, which were heavily, ice would go through there constantly. And well, one of those days I was walking kids home from Woodcrest to Fridley Terrace, we saw ICE agents wait until school let out and grab parents. I want to say that you guys, you took it all on. National media, it was tough. It was really heart-wrenching and tough. And so I just beg my colleagues to believe what these people are saying. In my faith tradition, I see this as the moral and just thing to do. Supporting immigrants is a moral obligation. We welcome the stranger and treat them with dignity because they're made in God's image. And so Mary and Brenda, I just really want to thank you because you epitomized that during these past few months. And I really thank you for believing their words and treating all those kiddos and their families as our families, because it was pretty inspiring to see everybody wrap their arms around those kids. But we need to do more, and we need to make sure that their parent, that our communities are made right. So I just really wanted to thank you for all the advocacy you guys have been doing.
Thank you, Chair.
Makes me sad to leave.
Thank you. Dr. Lewis and Ms. Grenland, there wasn't a question, but if you would like to make a comment, please do.
I just want to say thank you for believing what happened in Fridley Public Schools, Columbia Heights Public Schools. What you saw in the news was the gentle version, and it ripped our communities to the core.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that. I spent my birthday in mid-January not having dinner with my family, but literally chasing armed agents who left in vans that, when I showed the video to somebody later who had been to war, said, "This looks like Fallujah." They were right behind our high school. And yet, here we are. And while you see our faces and you hear our voices sharing the stories of our community, just know that, again, as Dr. Lewis said, that is the gentle version. And we are here sharing the stories, not just of the things that we saw, but that our community experienced and continues in some ways to experience today. So again, thank you, Representative Cagle, for your tireless advocacy, because you're right. There was a lot of phone calls, there was a lot of tears, and yet still we rise. So,
thank you again. Thank you both for being here. Representative Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for having this conversation today. I think it's really important that we do this in ways and means, because we're actually able to talk about some of the underlying issues in this space that we see the outcomes of across the policy committees. I think that we have this tendency to view the economy as separate from us, as separate from the people. And the economy is actually made up of us. The economy is a series and a web of relationships that connects us actually across differences. It's made up of the families and schools and kids and businesses and local governments and kind of a bunch of the perspectives that you heard today. And the fact of the matter is that you cannot visit a multidimensional crisis like this on one part of the economy, whether that's a certain geography or people of a certain immigration status or people of certain colors, right? Because you can't tell somebody's immigration status by looking at them, so that is what happens in practice. You cannot visit a multidimensional crisis on one part of the economy without the kind of cascading impacts that we've heard about here today. And we are being peddled a hateful and inhuman and inhumane lie by our leaders. That's what led us to this place. We are told, and it starts with the economy. It starts with an acknowledgement of the real economic squeeze that's being felt by people across our cities, across our state, across our country, right? But we're told that this economic squeeze is not because of billions of dollars of tax cuts given to the Epstein class and the biggest corporations in the country. It's not because of tariffs, right, that are driving up the cost of everything. It's not because we're kicking tens of millions of people off health care, which drives up the cost of everybody's health care, whether you're one of those 10 million people or not. It's not because we're entering this, like, disastrous war of choice that is driving up gas prices, that's costing us literally billions of dollars a day, the impacts of which we will be feeling for months and years to come. By the way, if you didn't see the latest inflation numbers, record high in the last few years, 3.3%, that was announced last week. And we're told it's not because of any of this. That's what this inhuman lie that is peddled by our leaders tells us. It's not the cost of housing and childcare and healthcare and food and utilities and everything is going up, not because of any of that list of things. It's because of immigrants. It's because immigrants are here and they're driving up the cost of housing and they're driving up the cost of food and utilities. And we're told, don't look up, Don't look at the people benefiting from this economy. Don't look at the 1% who own 30% of the wealth in our country, as much as the bottom 90%. Don't look at the leaders. Don't look at the tariffs. Don't look at the war. Look to your left and your right, to your immigrant neighbors, and blame them. That is the lie that underlies this whole thing. It's scapegoating. It's common. We've seen it throughout history. But it's incredibly dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous because this lie that's being peddled to us, we were presented a picture today of what that looks like when it's implemented. A little picture of it, and we've seen it all unfold across our communities. Because the logical outcome of this lie, the enforcement of this worldview, looks like the pictures that you have all seen from my neighborhood and across the state of armed paramilitary masked forces brutalizing, beating, assaulting, murdering, harassing, murdering citizens, right? You've seen the logical outcome of this worldview is illegal racial profiling, as we talked about. You can't just say, oh, people of this immigration status, it's not written on our faces or our coats what our immigration status is, so you have to have the kind of scenes that Chief Brulee told us about in order to enforce this worldview. And in order to enforce this worldview, you have to visit lasting damage upon our economy, because the economy is not separate from us. It is us. It's made up of us. And so I would just ask us to live in the world. I would ask us to look around. I would ask us to acknowledge, like, you can't be rabidly anti-immigrant and pro-small business in our country. It's not how the economy works. You can't be anti-immigrant and pro-Minnesota economy, pro-business. That's not how the economy works. Look around. Deal with reality. Immigrants are net contributors to our public coffers. Immigrants have revitalized main streets across the state, from Lake Street, which is my main street, to, you know, every small town that has a bump in Main Street. It's because of immigrants in our state. Like, entire critical sectors of our economy, hospitality, food, construction, rely on immigrant labor to keep moving. And look around at what happens when that's disrupted. And we have an aging population and, like, cratering population growth. The immigrants are the people who, if, like, Social Security exists when I'm retirement age, it will be because enough immigrants moved to the country to pay for it. Like, that is what we're facing. And so, you know, I want us all to be compelled by our shared humanity to treat each other with the love and respect that all of God's children, all of creation's children deserve. I want that to be our motivation. But if that doesn't work for you, please at least consider the cascading impacts on our economy. The fact that we cannot have a shared prosperity if we're scapegoating and counting out large swaths of our neighbors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Vice Chair Abadji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Always hard to follow Chair Gomez. I mean, just a couple of things I want to highlight. You know, the report that Minneapolis gave us, they actually had an interesting section in there about the mental health toll that this is taking on our communities. And what that mental health toll is not only just the lack of access to mental health care, but it's the fact that people's safety and stability was disrupted by Operation Metro Surge. People's nervous systems still haven't come back. People are still scared to move around their communities. They're scared of when they get a notice or when they get a letter or when they get a phone call or when someone knocks on their door. That fear is lasting. And that fear also has an effect on our economy because it dictates then how people act in our economy, whether they buy something as consumers or whether they go to work for all the hours that may or may not be available to them. Or whether they're able to help us with, you know, harvests that we have on our farms. I think that we will see those lasting effects. And I kind of just want to say to that, too, like, yes, Minnesota has had some economic indicators that show that in some areas we're in some distress, and that was before the surge. But I think any of those previous issues don't necessarily negate the hundreds of millions of dollars that we are seeing is necessary for not only our cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul, but across the entire state. So I would just say that as we are considering how much we want to supply from our state coffers to support businesses across the state, that we don't try to tie it to this idea that, well, you were in some type of distress before, so maybe you're not deserving as much. Additionally, I think, you know, a lot of the people who have, we talk a lot about people who are leaving Minnesota. People are leaving Minnesota, wealthy people are leaving Minnesota, big businesses are leaving Minnesota. But what's actually happening is that, especially during the surge, our immigrants have been leaving Minnesota. I've heard earlier today that many of them have actually left the entire country. And they've left the state. So instead of worrying so much about what happens to our big businesses and our wealthy individuals that we wring our hands over, I think we should really be concerned about the workers who have left here, the employees, the caregivers who help keep our economy running. As Chair Gomez said, the economy is made of people. People who ensure that those things continue to be available in our communities to provide the type of safe and vibrant communities that we want. And so whatever amount of funding that we give, it's not going to be charity, but it's actually going to be a strategic investment. And it's an opportunity to ensure that we revitalize our state. And I'm proud of all the people who came out into the streets to push back against the lawlessness of our federal government. And I think it's our turn to support all of those efforts that have happened. And we've heard from all the testifiers today that everyone else has acted. CDFIs have acted. Our cities have acted. Our counties have acted. Individuals have acted. Philanthropy has acted. The state has not yet had a chance to act. And this is our opportunity. And I hope we will take it and do something really meaningful to support those who have been doing the work to keep Minnesotans afloat. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Katisa-Batum.
Thank you, Chair Frazier, and I appreciate the testifiers who came to share their stories with us today, and all those who have submitted written testimony as well. I just want to call members' attention to the letter from the Children's Defense Fund, and Ms. Fitzsimmons did a great job when she was testifying as well. But you know, as co-chair of the Children and Families Committee, I think we need to put a fine point on the impact that this has had on the children and families of Minnesota. She spoke about toxic stress and how it disrupts brain architecture, impairs learning and memory, and it increases the risk of lifelong physical and mental health challenges. In addition, she spoke briefly about adverse childhood experiences, things like being separated from caregivers, chronic fear, household instability, poverty. These are long-term outcomes, right? They're strongly associated with depression, cardiovascular disease, substance use disorders, and reduced educational attainment. It says, these impacts are not theoretical. They are biologically embedded and can shape a child's trajectory for decades. Now, the Operation Metro Surge was targeted, but what preceded it briefly was that members in leadership in this body partnered with an amateur YouTuber to highlight unsubstantiated claims about Somali child care centers here in Minnesota. And President Trump responded by sending over 3,000 ICE and DHS members to disrupt our communities. In my community, we had volunteers at bus stops. We were sitting in gas stations. We were driving through apartment parking lots, making sure that our neighbors who were coming home from work or trying to leave to go to work would not be abducted. My children came home and told me stories of their classmates, families being displaced, people who had made Eden Prairie their home for years, who were going back to their country of origin. We had our own family travel concerns. We were traveling internationally. My sixth grade son said, "Are they going to take us away at the airport?" For those of you who don't know, and you can't know by looking at me, this white skin that I live in, three of my kids are biracial. And we had concerns about sending our kids to the bus stop in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, wealthy suburban neighborhood. But because my children's skin is a different color than mine, that was something that we experienced personally. And I want to just talk about how this ties into these adverse childhood experiences and the trauma stacking that Minnesota kids have dealt with for the last at least 6 years, but way beyond that. My five-year-old was born during a worldwide pandemic. His mother was on a hit list. My kids are afraid to open their front door. And then ICE comes to town. And my five-year-old says, "People are going to just come and knock on our door and ask if any brown people live here?" And I said, "I hope not." But we saw that happening in St. Paul. We saw it happening in a lot of other communities. And so we told the kids, "Do not open the door." Because maybe there's a psychopath assassin on the other side. Maybe there are immigration agents who are coming to try to take our brown kids away. Who wants to become a parent in today's society? And we talk about the dwindling population that we face in Minnesota, and it's not just here in Minnesota. But there are stark realities that young people have to face when they think, "Am I going to have children? Can I physically have children?" And these conversations that we have about how expensive it is to raise children in today's day and age. These issues are going to reverberate through our communities for years. And this investment in businesses who have been impacted by Operation Metro Surge, I think, Mr. Chair, is truly the least that we can do at this point in the game. And it needs to be paired with additional investments in mental health and access to supportive services and work supports and family economic security, because the kids are not all right. They are resilient, but they're not all right. And we've got a lot of work to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Backer, and we do have a couple more people on the list.
That's fine. We're running out of time, so that's fair.
You want to pass?
Well, okay, I'll be brief. Thank you, Chair.
All right.
Hey. You know, I will not deny the fact that what happened in Minneapolis had an effect on businesses. I'm a small business owner. At the same time, I do want to just share two things. To say that the only current businesses that are leaving the state are wealthy businesses, I think would not look at the full picture. I represent on the western part of Minnesota, so if we go down to Canada, down to Iowa, we no longer have a larger community on the Minnesota side. So there's been government policies that have pushed families. I mean, we're not talking about wealthy people on my end of the state. We're talking about people, because it's easier to live in North Dakota, South Dakota. These communities are larger on the North Dakota side. So we have to look at that whole aspect, like Representative Baker said. And also, I would argue, and this may get some people challenged with me, that the state has responded, not on the economic impact, but it takes two to tangle. And I'm not saying I'm happy with how the administration acted, but I'm also not happy with how our governor acted. When you put people in the street in blowing whistles, in harm's way as an EMS personnel, I'm like, that is not the right decision to do that. So when you do that, of course you're going to get more pushback from the administration to send more ICE agents. So we have to look at the whole picture of this. We also have to look at how many businesses just shut down because of that. And I'm very concerned about Minneapolis. You know, I have people in my district who wants to come down to Minneapolis. And over the last 6, 7, 8 years, starting with COVID, they have not. So we have to look at ways to strengthen businesses in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But there is more than just one side of it. And I'm very open to working on this. And I appreciate the feedback and stories that we've heard from many people. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair Becker. I just will note that no one needs permission to exercise their First Amendment rights. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The damage is done. And quite frankly, I think what we have seen and witnessed with our own eyes, documented by Minnesotans, will be discussed for many years to come. We have lost Minnesotans to this Operation Metro Search. Renee Good, Alex Brady have lost their lives. Minnesotans have shown courage, resilience, and they've shown the world who we are. When neighbors come to stand to support one another, from schools to places of worship to businesses, they have shown us who we can be and what we can do collectively. When our own federal government is weaponized against the state of Minnesota and the people of Minnesota, we have to recognize that it's going to take all of us to fight back. It requires us to understand that the economic damage that is done to many of the immigrants and non-immigrants, we can take the lead. When neighbors were only equipped with whistles and their phones to show that the world can see what was happening on our streets day in, day out, when our children are living in fear, when our families are living in fear, when they cannot even go outside to buy their own groceries, medication, go to hospitals. Also, when things are happening in our own hospitals, when we're told that a gentleman ran into a wall and broke the skull, nothing is further from the truth if we don't say what happened. We have to admit it. We've got work to do. And yes, we will continue to support Minnesotans during this difficult time and address the challenges that we're faced with. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Chair Bento.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your work on this. If Metro Surge had been somehow a storm surge, this would not even be a question. We would absolutely be doing this. And the fact that this was this action by the federal government makes it all the more necessary. And I just want to point out that whatever you think about the issue, about what was going on, it was not these individual businesses that had any responsibility anyway for any of that, if you have a different perspective. So ultimately, if this was a natural disaster, we'd absolutely be acting on it. We'd be doing so for moral grounds. And as Chair Gomez said, we'd also be doing so because it's in the self-interest of everyone, of every Minnesotan and every one of our communities to have this happen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Torkelson. Please call those out.
Well, I have no further comments on the issues at hand. I do have comments about the next meeting. Is that where I'm at?
Okay. That is, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for this hearing. It's always good to learn about things, so that's what we're here for. As far as the next meeting goes, we do intend to put a number of bills on the calendar. I encourage members who have bills that they believe should be heard in Ways and Means to contact us, and we will evaluate them. Not every bill is going to get heard, of course, but we would like to get more bills moving. I think that's what we're here for. I believe we will see some financial bills coming out of some of our committees this week as chairs get together bipartisanly and construct a bill from a variety of committees, I look forward to seeing the results of their work as they come to Ways and Means. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Co-Chair Torkelson. Members, with that, thank you for the lively conversation and robust debate. This committee is adjourned.